WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
You're a good man, Charlie Brown. You're good at what you do, too.
She is Natalie Jacobson.
You are the dean of South Shore Broadcasters.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
Best-selling author, Dave Wedge. You got to say that.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mayor. Yes. Thank you. Wonderful to be here. Kevin, it's been a long time. Thanks for all you do. You're a local news icon. We appreciate it.
Kathy's doing a great job at this. And I've decided she's jelly. I got to be peanut butter.
There was a debate about that.
You fine with jelly?
I'm fine with jelly.
Okay, good. Jelly spikes my sugars.
Good evening and welcome to Monday Night Talk. As you know, I am not Kevin Tachi, and I'm going to be your host for the first hour.
Massachusetts State Auditor Diana DeZoglio, welcome back to Monday Night Talk.
It's great to be back. Thanks so much for having me, Kevin.
Jermaine Wiggins, member of the 2001 Super Bowl champion New England Patriots. Welcome to Monday Night Talk.
Oh, thank you for having me. Anytime.
Not just economic development, but it's how to get the businesses involved.
Senator, I want to thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate you being a voice bringing so much community news to folks here on the South Shore.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are indeed tuned into another episode of Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. Good evening. We have a great lineup. We're actually going to start off out of the gate real fast, but just a little tease for later on in the show. We're going to talk with Chris DiOrio. We'll talk a little bit about the Karen Reed case and how that's going. Also, let's not forget that Chris also just completed yet another marathon. He was one of the runners in the 128th running of the Boston Marathon. We'll find out how he is recovering, and we'll talk NFL draft. That's right. Later on this week, the NFL draft kicks off on Thursday night. We'll talk with Brendan Conley about that. But we start off with Weymouth Mayor, former state senator, and original host of Monday Night Talk, none other than Bob Hedlund. Mayor, how are you doing on this fine evening?
Excellent. Nice to be with the Cal Ripken of Monday Night Talk.
The Cal Ripken. Wait, I don't know if I've done 2,131 days shows in a row.
Yeah, but I think you hold a record for consecutive shows uninterrupted.
Okay, I like that. That works for me.
And I'm waiting for you to take a night off so I can just take the controls over for one night. Just one night. Don't worry. Looking to come back.
Well, what if I wanted to just give you the microphone and just kind of hang out in the studio and see what you do?
I want you away because I, you know, you don't trust me. No. I know why you don't trust me too, but.
Wait a minute.
You probably don't remember why you don't trust me.
You'll have to tell me why. I know you want to do like a whole Dwayne Glasscock type of a thing. And you tease something like that. Let's do that. That was kind of a.
No, you got upset with me on Dave Wedge's last night. And I happened to be in the studio for that with you. And I conspired with Larry to.
Play some of your old stuff?
No. We played Memories, whatever the Barbra Streisand song is, you know. Memories, like the corners. And you were rather perturbed about that because it wasn't how you laid out the show that night.
Yeah, I don't think so, because that's your MO. I remember when I was kind of your, you know, your occasional sidekick or co-host, and I would line up a guest. I'm like, hey, they want to come in and talk about this. And we wouldn't talk about that. You would find we would talk whatever current events were. If you knew they were a baseball fan, you talk Phillies and Mets and all that. That's
my ADD kicked in. It's very spontaneous.
I don't get mad, Mayor. But how are things in the great town of? Do I call it town or city? What do you like? What is it?
We are officially known as the city known as the town of Weymouth.
Okay. How are things in Weymouth?
Let me explain that for your listeners. So we did a charter change, changed our form of government to a city form of government, but the Charter Commission and the voters wanted to retain, you know, a little bit of history, as we are the second oldest town in the Commonwealth. So we kept the town designation. Braintree actually copied our charter a few years later and did the same thing. Framingham recently copied our charter for the most part. And they are also known as the city known as the town of Framingham.
Historical facts. I love it.
Yep.
Well, so we're coming into that time of year. I'm sure you've prepared and you're putting forth your ninth budget.
Correct.
How has it been putting this budget together, and how does it compare to your previous ones?
This budget has been our most challenging budget for a few reasons. You know, state aid's not great, pretty flat. State aid percentage is nowhere near keeping up with inflation or, you know, personnel, contracts, collective bargaining agreements. We've been lucky. We've had a lot of new growth in our tax base. If you drive around Weymouth, you see a lot of redevelopment. That's leveled off a little bit. And we got socked with our highest increase by far, double of any previous increase in our health insurance costs. That's been a huge hit in the millions of dollars. The obviously ongoing inflation, increases in personnel costs, union contracts, et cetera. So it's a tough year. We've asked our department heads to come in pretty tight. And of course the school budget will be a challenge, for them to meet our targets.
The thing that I've had conversations with other communities, other municipalities, and it's, you know, the ask usually is greater than 5%. I think some of the numbers I was looking at for the school budget that was being proposed was a little greater than 5%, a couple of million more than fiscal 24. I thought that there was a Student Opportunity Act that was passed a few years just prior to COVID. It was going to, you know, for the next 7 years, that the Commonwealth would be trying to funnel more money into education and help in this area. It as someone who oversees, you know, you have your budget, does it seem as though the state is putting forth any more into education when it comes to you trying to put together a municipal budget?
Not where it keeps pace with mandates and increased costs, so it's frustrating. I will say that despite the challenges, Weymouth has put itself in a position where we're able to weather this. You know, if it keeps going in the direction it's going in, it's certainly unsustainable for everybody, all communities. But, you know, just as a comparison, and this is an opportunity for us to kind of toot our horn a little bit, when I came in 8+ years ago, we were way below our net school spending requirements. We were, you know, potentially facing receivership or fines. And we only had about $1 million in our stabilization account. One of our neighboring communities that's quite similar to Weymouth, but has a much broader commercial tax base. I won't name the name, but, you know, for comparison's sake, they had $10 million in their stabilization account. And now we're in a situation where we've got $10 million in our stabilization, and that community is facing a $10 to $15 million budget shortfall. The reason for that is, you know, we went in two different directions. We aggressively pursued redevelopment. We had new growth in our tax base. The other community, in reaction to a controversial project, kind of pulled back on that and held off on redevelopment. They were undergoing a master plan process and decided to hold off on a lot of redevelopment during that period. And, you know, they had no growth in their tax base. And that's what we rely on because of those other factors we just mentioned. Inflationary costs, collective bargaining agreements, things, expenses going up, state aid remaining flat. The only way you bridge that gap is through your tax levy. And you can do it either with new growth or you can do it with an override or a tax increase. And we're fortunate we've kept our tax rate very low.
Mary, it's worth asking when you're talking about development. An initiative put forth by the Baker-Polito administration in 2021. I think it was something they started putting together in 2020 and signed into law in 2021. And that is the MBTA Communities Act. That's where there's creation of overlay districts, zoning to be friendly for affordable housing, 177 communities, whether you have the commuter rail that comes through your community, you're an adjacent or neighboring community. Where does Weymouth stand when it comes to the MBTA Communities Act?
First, let me say something about the law itself. And as someone who served in the legislature for 20 years.
Please do.
I think it's an abomination that a law of this magnitude went through the legislative process without any debate. It just, you know, flew under the radar. And I don't know. I don't believe there was any significant debate. There wasn't much coverage on this, and all of a sudden, you know, communities have to contend with it. And how did that happen? You know, what happened? Where were our elected officials on this to vet it and take into consideration community concerns, communities like Milton and others that are struggling with this? So that's one problem. When the law came out, it was it was very vague. You know, we were waiting for regs to be fine-tuned by the state. And what we were concerned about in Weymouth was in 2016, 2017, we undertook a zoning change. We, you know, targeted our commercial corridors for redevelopment, and we had tremendous success. We talked about the new growth that led to the new growth that's helped us, you know, fund all kinds of capital projects in Weymouth without overrides of tax increases. And so we were ahead of the curve, so to speak. So our concern was, are we going to get credit for the things we did prior to the implementation of the law? And it looks like we are. So we haven't finalized the districts that we have to create, although they're pretty much in place. We have to fine-tune them in reaction to the law. But we've created additional housing and met the targets in that law. Our concern was, as I said, just to make sure that the work that did get done in Weymouth prior to the implementation of the law, we get credit for those new housing starts, which it looks like we are. So we're in great shape on that.
Well, let's talk about projects in, whether it's capital projects, maybe road projects that might be beginning because of the warmer weather. Where do things stand for Weymouth? And this is your opportunity to kind of share with folks who are tuned in.
Yeah, it's going great. I mean, again, all that new growth, some of the ARPA money, the way we've managed our debt service was a huge change from what went on in the past. That's allowed us to do every one of our parks over. If you drive down 3A, you'll see another new park that we're doing, Beals Park, complete makeover for that site. We've done all of our playing fields. We've created three new parks, Heritage Park, King Oak Hill Park, and Osprey Overlook Park at our old dump. All of the stuff we've been doing capital project-wise, again, no overrides, unlike Hingham that has two capital overrides in place right now. They even did an operating override for $800,000, which blows my mind because it's quite a wealthy town with a great tax base. The things that are kicking in this spring and summer, we'll be completing the Columbian Square signalization, pedestrian improvements, and streetscape improvements over there. That was an $11 million project. We are breaking ground shortly, beginning of next month. Congressman Lynch is going to be joining us. There's a little bit of state federal participation on our beach connection and coastal embankment stabilization project up in North Weymouth. We're excited about that. Very complicated project, 7 years of permitting and engineering. So that's exciting. We're finally going to see some activity on that. So a lot going on. We've got huge infrastructure improvements going on. We're upgrading pump stations for sewer capital projects. And, of course, you've heard about the project to bring MWRA water to Weymouth. That's going to be huge for the town and our future.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Mayor Bob Hedlund, mayor of Weymouth. Talking about some of the things that are going on, kind of a little bit of an update, community update. One of the things that I know a lot of communities are dealing with, depending on if they're a gateway city or maybe if they're a neighboring community, and that is the migrant situation. Is Weymouth dealing with something similar when it comes to folks who are looking to be sheltered here from another country?
Well, we don't have the type of hotels or motels that seem to be serving as shelters for migrants in Massachusetts. We had one that was a victim or beneficiary of our redevelopment initiatives a while back, the old Boston Motel. Ironically, in a bit of history, that was a placement area, shelter or housing for asylees during the Obama administration. And it really impacted the town and services back then. We had approximately 3 school buses a day servicing the motel. We had a lot of social service agencies would go in and inform the migrants of their rights, opportunities, benefits, and created an awful situation, in my opinion, where a new arrival would be considered homeless because of their status, which would give them preference over veterans and income-eligible people at one of our state-subsidized housing developments. So that changed the makeup of that housing development pretty significantly. And, you know, I didn't think it was fair that a veteran would take a back seat or an income-eligible person who may have lived their whole life in Weymouth, you know, had to go to the back of the line, so to speak, from an asylee placement that was considered homeless under that category and could get in ahead of those folks at our housing facility. So we're not really experiencing that now, given the fact that we don't have really the facilities. Although there's a rumor floating around today, and it was floating around the last few weeks, and we've tamped down on it. But when you have Facebook now, people can just ruminate, throw things out there. And there's a rumor that the St. Jerome School, which is closed, is serving or will be serving as a migrant shelter. We have gotten no evidence of that from the state, although the state has not been good in notifying communities or has not been notifying communities when they place migrants, but we haven't, we've reached out and haven't heard any confirmation from, the Catholic Church or the Archdiocese.
So a quick, just shifting our direction, segueing from talking about what's going on in Weymouth and just talking a little one-on-one with you, Bob, and that is, last week, we saw the passing of O.J. Simpson. And
Whitey Herzog.
Whitey Herzog, yeah.
You know who passed away that didn't get the coverage?
Who?
Of, if you're talking sports figures, that didn't get the coverage of Whitey Herzog, and I think he should have, and I think he probably warranted more coverage, is Ken Holtzman.
No kidding.
Pitched 2 no-hitters in his career. Great no-hitter, famous game with the Cubs. He won, I think, 3 World Series rings with the Oakland A's. Hit a home run as a pitcher in a World Series game that was a clutch home run. So
no fanfare.
I didn't see much on that one as a baseball fan that I expected.
Well, I bring up OJ because you posted a little bit of a remembrance in the degree of that you crossed paths with this individual back in 2000. You share a story of, you know, I guess you had a little bit of a conversation.
You know, they think I was glamorizing a murderer or something, but I was just stating an anecdote about someone who was in the news, you know.
Yep.
And that story has a little radio connection, doesn't it?
It does. It does.
So I was in the Bahamas with a few friends, and kind of in an isolated area, but we ventured into Lakaya and we went to a bar to get a drink, and we couldn't get service. It was crowded. So we decided, you know, half of them went one, the other 3 went across the bar, and I stayed on one side, and we said, whoever gets the attention of the bartender first. And I weaseled into the bar, and there was a guy with his back to me, and I ordered a beer, and the guy sort of bumped me, and I said, excuse me. And he said, excuse me. And it was OJ Simpson. And he just started chatting me up. He was alone. It was weird. And I mentioned a little connection. I have a cousin, an uncle whose cousin played in the NFL against him. I mentioned his name and, you know, said I grew up a Patriots fan. And he started talking football and blah, 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 and talked about Patriots were his favorite team. And I said, oh, really? And he goes, yeah, you know why? And I said, no, why? He said, because I always rushed for 100 against them. So he seemed lonely and he was chatty and I was waiting for my beer, and I engaged him in a conversation. And at one point, I said, OJ, can I ask you a question? Or maybe I called him Mr. Simpson.
Yes.
And he said, sure, what? And, of course, when I tell the story, people are going to say, oh, you didn't ask him if he did it, did you? But, no, I noticed, and I'm not a fan of Howard Stern. I don't listen to his show, but I used to channel surf when he had his TV show every once in a while. And he always had that mugshot of OJ over his shoulder in the camera shot. And he was always going on rants about OJ Simpson. And I said, what's Howard Stern's problem with you? And he got all animated and said, I'm glad you asked. He goes, people don't know the backstory with me and him. He said, but I was on the board of directors of, I believe it was Entercom at the time, the parent company that had the Howard Stern show, the radio chain. And when Howard Stern got that record $1 million FCC fine, do you remember that?
I do.
They had an internal debate at Entercom amongst the board of directors, of which OJ was one. And OJ led the discussion to advocate for taking the $1 million fine out of Stern's pay. That was the debate, whether the company would pay the fine or they would dock Stern the $1 million. And that was why Stern, one of the reasons why probably Stern was trashing him a lot on the air.
As we get ready to wrap up, give you an opportunity, I see that the list of summer concerts in Weymouth have been released. Are you somebody who attends these, or does it depend on who the lineup is that you may pop in?
Good question, right? I've attended a couple that I wasn't there for the music, but I was there more as my role as mayor. But this year I intend on plan to attend a number of them based on the act itself. So I'm excited this summer.
Excellent.
We have the great Draw the Line, local Aerosmith tribute band. We've got Pink Houses, which we haven't announced yet. Great John Mellencamp tribute band from Bob Anderson and Sue Rand. Although Mellencamp's really been acting weird lately, as you may have seen. Have you seen?
I have, yeah, where I guess he stormed off stage when he was trying to talk about Biden.
I guess, and then, you know, he wouldn't stand up for the national anthem at that football game. He was munching on popcorn. That was pathetic. But Bob Anderson looks like John Mellencamp. He sings better than John Mellencamp. Mm. The band behind him is really a crack band, but the difference is Bob Anderson stands up for the Pledge of Allegiance, where Mellencamp does not. Or the national anthem, I should say. We have a Van Halen tribute band that's really good coming in. The name escapes me at the moment. They just changed their name. So it's a good lineup this summer. Divas with a Twist, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, yeah. And our new library, I might add, which is built without an override.
Well, we have to wrap up, unfortunately, but you know, knowing that today is April 22nd, this day in music history, couple of things that I thought maybe you might find interesting. In 74, The Who began filming their movie version of Tommy.
Before my time, sort of.
Okay.
You know, starting to come of age with music at that time, but I didn't get into The Who right away, and I never liked the movie.
Okay. Well, interesting enough, 1978, performing at the Ottawa Civic Center, the Bat Out of Hell tour, Meatloaf falls off the stage and actually mangles his knee where he actually needs surgery. He actually does the next few shows from a wheelchair.
Oh, my God. So I have an anecdote about Meatloaf.
You have 30 seconds.
Oh, God. I have a friend that was working for him as his tour manager. They came to Boston. He said, do you want to go? I said, yeah, but I got a softball game that night. So I got there late. It was a championship game for the Hingham Men's League. We get there, brings him backstage, introduces me to Meat, or Mr. Loaf. And there's only a couple people in the room. He had just had both hips replaced, sweating profusely. We're in his trailer. And he said, what'd you think of the first song? My daughter wrote that song. And I said, gee, Mr. Loaf, I got here a little late. I missed the first song. I didn't want to tell him I only caught the last three songs. And he looks at me and he says, oh, yeah, you had an important softball game tonight, didn't you? And I said, yeah, we won the Hingham Men's Championship. And he went on to tell us about how when Bat Out of Hell went platinum, he was an avid softball player, and he put it in the contract. The record company was sending him out, and he didn't want to miss any of his games on Long Island, so he put it in that he had to be home for his softball games, and he said he made all his games that year. So we had that in common. That was a pretty cool story.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us for this segment, Mayor.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure to talk music with you.
We have to do something a little more extensive in the near future. What do you think?
Yeah, yeah. And Saxon, May 5th in Boston. How's the Blues? You going?
Probably not, but I'm sure I'm gonna live vicariously through some of the videos that you post on Facebook.
I will put a couple of live ones up.
There he is. Weymouth Mayor, Bob Hedlund, our guest here on Monday Night Talk. We're gonna step aside and we'll come back more Monday Night Talk.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
If you want to drink, that's your business. If you want to stop, that's for Alcoholics Anonymous.
AA is an inclusive fellowship of individuals all around the world. The one thing you need to ask yourself is, am I ready to do something about my drinking problem? For more information, literature, and videos about Alcoholics Anonymous, go to AA.org. To find a meeting near you, call 617-426-9444 or visit aaboston.org.
Eat, drink, and socialize at the Patio at McWiggins in Whitman Center. Sit down with a specialty cocktail and start your meal off with a patio sampler with chicken wings, egg rolls, potato skins, fried cauliflower, and chicken and biscuits. Watch the game on 7 55-inch monitors while digging into braised short ribs, fish tacos, fig and goat cheese flatbread, or Koji steak tips. Relax and listen to the live entertainment at the patio every Friday and Saturday night. And don't forget, McWiggins Pub next door. They're located at 546 and 552 Washington Street in downtown Whitman.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
And we return for more Monday Night Talk. If you're just tuning in, just keep in mind, if you have questions in regards to any of the segments that we have, MondayNightTalk@gmail.com. Maybe you have a suggestion for a radio segment. Well, then again, MondayNightTalk@gmail.com. We're fortunate. Our next guest happens to be a gentleman who is not only the CEO and founder of a nonprofit, but he's also an author and somebody who is an expert when it comes to congenital heart defect. He is Eric Ankerud. And he's here to talk to us a little bit about not only his nonprofit, but talk to us about his book, Heartfelt Dreams, A Story of Perseverance, Providence, Faith, and Love. Eric, welcome to Monday Night Talk.
Well, thank you very much. It's my pleasure to join you on Monday Night Talk.
If you will, you're a New England native, somebody who actually resides in probably one of my favorite states, New Hampshire. Is that correct?
That is correct. We're in Hollis, New Hampshire.
Oh, God bless you. I'm somebody I like North Conway, probably everybody does. And there's other spots as well. And I get family that lives up there as well, but we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk a little bit about, you as a remarkable individual who has taken on the role as a nonprofit founder. You're an author and, you have a story to tell in regards to your wife, Lori, if you will. Let's first start out talking a little bit about you and your wife. How did you guys meet?
Well, Lori and I grew up in Western New York, and we actually met at a hockey game. I was playing hockey, and Lori was attending the hockey game with a friend of hers, and a friend of mine who was on the hockey team blasted a slap shot that went over the glass, struck her friend, and from that point on, I saw her in the stands, and that's how we met.
Okay. And as you grew closer and closer, realized that she was the one, you also probably learned, you got to learn a little bit about some of her life and her backstory as someone who has dealt with CHD.
Yes, I did. And it was an interesting journey for me and learning about Lori's condition. She was born in the 1950s at a time when open heart surgery had not yet evolved, and most of the infants born with congenital heart defects did not survive past the first year because the surgeons and cardiologists didn't know how to care for them. And so she happened to be in the right place at the right time. Her mother was wise enough to take her, once she was born, to Buffalo Children's Hospital, in Buffalo, New York, where there were two of the world's leading cardiologists experimenting with patients and babies that were born with congenital heart defects. And a congenital heart defect is a structural defect in the heart. And in my wife's case, she had four major defects in her heart, one of which was a hole in the heart. And so being brought to Buffalo Children's at a time when the heart-lung machine was invented, which allowed for the surgeons to stop the heart while they operated on it and keep the patient alive. And she was one of the very first infants in the country to have open heart surgery for a congenital heart defect. So she has been kind of regarded as a pioneering patient. And so I learned all of this through our journey after we got married, which took about 20 years to figure things out.
Well, you guys are a year away from your 40th anniversary. What are some of the things that you've learned and that she's had to endure as she tries to, deal with CHD?
Well, when after we met and I started to learn about CHD and what the patients go through, we searched the Northeast, especially in New England, for a cardiologist that knew how to care for an adult now with a congenital heart defect, because, again, most of the children didn't survive into adulthood. So as medical technology advanced over the decades, more and more of these patients were surviving into adulthood. And we basically learned that the general cardiologist didn't know what to do with her. And I can vividly remember accompanying her to an appointment where the cardiologist, who actually had a child born with a congenital heart defect, really told her he didn't really know how to care for her. And when she got back in the car, was crying because she just didn't know where this was going to lead to. And it was only through my job, and I've been in the medical device industry for 30-plus years, and in a company that was working on cardiovascular surgical products, when I was walking one morning into a medical director's office to talk about a clinical research project and expressed my frustration and said, you happen to know anybody who would understand how to care for a congenital heart defect patient. And she mentioned that she had done her medical school training at Harvard and her fellowship at Mass General Hospital. And it was through that introduction that we met Dr. Richard Libertson, who at the time at Mass General was a world-leading expert in the condition my wife was born with called tetralogy of Fallot. And so it was at that point that our fortunes changed, because she now is with a doctor who could care for her condition.
Let's talk a bit about creating Heartfelt Dreams Foundation. How did that come about? And I would think that the vision would be to help others who might have had to travel the same path your wife did.
Well, we were fortunate during our marriage that, we were able to, maintain our family and have two children growing up. Mm-hmm. And we found that as we thought forward in our lives, what philanthropic endeavors would be of interest. And we couldn't settle on what might be the best approach. And it wasn't until 2015, when my wife's condition was deteriorating. And we lived in the typical New England colonial, and it got to a point where she couldn't go up and down the stairs to get to the bedroom, and she was having a difficult time with stamina, and it was all due to the fact that a congenital heart defect has no cure. It can only be repaired. And so the doctors at Mass General had told us that at some point, it was going to be a race between her age and the advancement in medical technology, because she would need surgery. And in 2015, we were told she had to go through major heart reconstructive surgery, just short of a transplant. Fortunately, one of the handful of surgeons in the country who could do the procedure happened to be at Mass General. She went through the 9.5-hour surgery, made very well, and went through 6 months of rehab. And to this day, she can still outwalk me. Very embarrassing situation. But over the next 3 years, and almost to the day, she had to have additional surgeries unrelated to her heart. And it came down to, in Thanksgiving of 2018, she had to go in for a knee operation. And the anesthesiologist came into the room as they were prepping her and was remarking that he had never seen anybody alive born with the heart condition that she had, and just stood there for about 20 minutes asking her questions and looking at her chart, and got to a point where I said to him, I think there's a surgeon waiting for her. Mm. And he walked up to me and looked me straight in the eye and said, you need to write a book. You need to write a book about your wife's condition and hope that it can benefit other patients. And it was at that point I told him, well, I can't write a book quite that fast, but while in the waiting room for her surgery to be completed, it just dawned on me that it was a congenital heart defect patient that needed support. And that was the birth of Heartfelt Dreams Foundation in early 2019, with the objective, really twofold objective. First was to provide emotional, educational, and financial support to congenital heart defect patients and their families, along with the medical professionals who care for these patients, because we learned that medical education is going to be an important part of more doctors being able to support these patients and their families through a lifelong journey.
If you're just tuning in, we are speaking with Eric Ankerud. He is not only the founder of a nonprofit, author, and congenital heart defect expert, talking with us and not only kind of giving us the timeline from, you know, meeting his wife to the, you know, creating the foundation to the birth of a book. So I would take it that you've never written a book before. What was your path like to write a book? Was it easy enough to kind of say, all right, let's lay this out? And it was basically about Lori's story, or was it just about the perseverance of a family with someone who is dealing with CHD?
Well, Lori is a very a person who really doesn't like the issue to be about herself. And as much as she's a pioneering patient, and in fact, her infant surgery is written up in a medical textbook, she doesn't want the story to be about herself. Okay. And so when we started Heartfelt Dreams Foundation, the idea was to make sure people understood it was the foundation providing the support. And so the idea for the book then stemmed from some of those early comments from the anesthesiologist and some other doctors that came to me and said, you know, you really need to tell the story. I had done a lot of writing in my career, but never a book. And so the idea became one of telling it from a perspective that would make Lori comfortable and make my wife comfortable about sharing her story and her experience. And so the book is really written from my perspective, a memoir from my perspective, and how it came to be that, you know, Lori and I met, and some of the real unique circumstances that led to decisions that we made in the course of our lives that really saved Lori's life. And so that's the approach that we took with the book. It took about 3 years to write. It was just recently published and released in February of this year. And the objective for the book is really to help not only congenital heart defect patients and their families with the challenges of a lifelong medical condition that oftentimes is very complex, and only specialty cardiologists know how to care and treat these patients, but also in general, people that go through the challenges in their lives and how perseverance and determination and dedication can really make a difference.
So almost like a book of hope for someone who may have a family member or somebody who may be going through this early in the early stages?
Yes, indeed it is. And when we decided to go forward with the book, my objective was that if we can have people read the book, and if they enjoy the story and enjoy the book and find some inspiration in it, all the proceeds from the sale of the book go to Heartfelt Dreams Foundation in supporting its mission. And so that really was the objective for the book, is to support the mission of Heartfelt Dreams Foundation and continue the progress that we're making in supporting these patients, oftentimes in need of not only the emotional support, but also practical issues like, how do I get to the hospital? How do I pay for a hotel? Because other accommodations aren't available to me. And so we provide free transportation, free hotel accommodations, and no questions asked. The only qualification to gain support from Heartfelt Dreams Foundation is a congenital heart defect diagnosis.
So I guess my question to you would be is were there, did you feel as though when you and Lori were looking for doctors and you were I guess, setting down this path, it, eventually being able to find somebody who was able to reconstruct her heart, that this was, there were a lot of firsts. This was something that still to this day, you would think with the technology that we have, that we would be so far in advance, that this is something that may not only help the person who's having issues, but maybe physicians who may be just coming into their own when it comes to CHD.
Well, that is very true. And we have a program where we're targeting the advanced cardiology fellows, the young doctors in hospitals that are learning about cardiology and hopefully specializing in congenital heart defects, because we think that there's a need for more. Right now in the country, there's only about 12 specialty heart centers that can care for these patients. And so patients oftentimes have to travel great distances. We're very fortunate in New England to have two hospitals in Mass General and Boston Children's that can treat congenital heart defect patients. And so that's a real blessing for patients that are in the Northeast and can make their way to Boston to have the care and treatment that their needs. There are about 36, 37 different kinds of congenital heart defects, and oftentimes they're very complex issues. And oftentimes the patients are suffering from other medical anomalies. And so it takes a real specialized physician to be able to provide the care and treatment that is needed. And we certainly experience that in our time together.
So as we get ready to wrap up our conversation, a couple more questions. I guess first and foremost, what did you learn about yourself after writing this book? And what have you heard? I'm sure you've already started hearing feedback from folks who have picked up the book, which I believe is available on Amazon. What are you hearing for feedback?
Well, the feedback initially has been very positive. I've been very pleased. I did say to Laurie and my family that, you know, I appreciate if you want to read the book, but I really need somebody outside of the family to tell me if it's a good read or not. And we received a very nice text message over April school vacation from a person who had acquired the book, took it to the beach, and said it was a great beach read. Thoroughly enjoyed the story, thoroughly enjoyed what it was about, and found it inspiring. And so we've been very pleased with the initial feedback. As you mentioned, it is available on Amazon. It's also available through the Heart Failure Dreams Foundation website. And so we're hoping that you know, people will acquire the book and find some benefit in their personal lives to what we have experienced and what we're sharing in this story.
And is there a website if folks want to find out more about the foundation or find out more about you and Laurie?
Yes, heartfeltdreamsfoundation.org. A Google search entering heart will call up Heartfelt Dreams Foundation, and that provides all the information about the services that are offered, the programs that we have, the golf tournament that we have every year to have some fun on the golf course. And any way to make a donation can be made through the website as well.
I usually like to hear in there, depending on the guest, I usually like to provide them with a blank check question. And basically it is, maybe there's something I haven't asked you during our interview, but you feel that you might want to touch upon before we say goodbye for now.
Well, I think there is. And the point that I try to emphasize is that congenital heart defects are the number one birth defect in the country, yet not everybody knows about it.
Right.
Because these patients don't necessarily show visible deformity. But it's a situation where babies, children, young adults, older adults need proper care and treatment because there is no cure.
So I would, you know, what would they normally do if they found out that a baby had a congenital heart defect? Would it normally just be a heart transplant? Would they try to fix the heart?
They can do a couple of things, and we are currently supporting about 20 babies. We receive 2 to 3 requests each day from families that need help with a congenital heart defect, and the babies oftentimes have to be diagnosed, first of all, and oftentimes they can be diagnosed during pregnancy, but upon birth, they have to be diagnosed, and then they are usually subjected to some kind of open-heart surgery as an infant. And if that surgery is successful, then the child starts to grow and may require other procedures in their early childhood or early teen years. And the key is that patients sometimes start feeling better and they don't think there's a problem. And that is a problem. They always need to see their cardiologist and make sure they're following up appropriately, because they may go for years or decades without needing any care. But once they do need care, it's really important that they get that treatment so that they can live a long and happy life.
If you're just tuning in, we've been privileged to be speaking with Eric Ankerroot. He is not only the founder of a nonprofit, Heartfelt Dreams Foundation, but here talking a little bit about his newly published book, Heartfelt Dreams, a story of perseverance, providence, faith, and love. Eric, I want to thank you so much for being my guest and sharing your story. And if you have any future events that are coming up, or there's a follow-up to this book, there's an open door that awaits you here at 95.9 WATD, right on Monday Night Talk.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity, and I'll be glad to follow up. And thanks again for having me on.
Right, and also tip of the cap to Drew for sending me an email and making me aware of this book, too.
I appreciate that as well.
You got it. All right, there he is. Eric Ankerroot, our guest for this segment. Oh, my goodness, where the heck did the first hour go? It's gone, but fear not. Hour number two straight ahead, warming up in the bullpen right now, Chris DiOrio. Find out about his run in just a moment here at 95.9 WATD.
South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. 95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com. Follow Monday Night Talk on Twitter. Start at 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add hashtag Monday Night Talk to your tweets. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
We return. Hour number two is upon you. Later this hour, we're going to talk a little NFL draft. That's right, the NFL draft, all the nonsense about what are the Patriots going to do at pick three. I'm going to bring in the great Brendan Conley from the WATD sports team. Also, he works for the Boston Herald. He'll join me, and we'll break this thing down as to the top 32, how it'll go. Not that we'll do any better, but we'll just pontificate about it. But right now, we bring in he's a regular guest. Wears many hats when we have him here. Whether he's here, he's calling in. It's actually a surprise, because I was expecting him to call in. He's like, I'm on my way. I'm like, yes, because there's a synergy when you got a person of Chris's caliber in studio, and he's got a great story to tell. Plus, he's going to share some of his legal wisdom. He is the head of our WATD Monday Night Talk legal team. Chris DiOrio, he's also a fantastic marathon runner, although, albeit he might say something different after we get done talking. He just completed another marathon. He ran the 128th running of the Boston Marathon, doing it for Mass General's, a pediatric cancer clinic, raising money for those who need it. Cancer is a deadly disease. And you know what? As an older person, you can't. That's one thing. But when you are so young, and there's nothing can be done, it's, you know, whatever we can do to help. And so Chris is here to kind of talk a little bit about his recent trek. It was a week ago, probably right about now. He was probably somewhere entering Wellesley. Chris, welcome back to Monday Night Talk, sir.
Thank you very much for having me, Kim.
How are you?
I'm better now than I was just about this time a week ago. Right about now, I was just passing by Boston College. Just passing by Boston College. I had just gotten over Heartbreak Hill at this point. Yes, I run marathons. I run is a questionable term. It was a long one. It was a slog, this time out, but, did finish.
Now tell folks, now how many Boston marathons have you run to date?
This is my fourth. Okay. My first one was during 2021, where they were the first time and only time they've run it in October. So I ran it in October of 2021 and then came back to run it again in April of 2022 when they ran it the quote-unquote normal way. and so I've been doing it ever since. So this would be number four.
And you have also ventured outside of the Commonwealth and I believe run the New York Marathon.
I did. I ran the New York City Marathon November of 2022. And just a great experience. I'm going to be running Chicago in October, so I'll have all of the American majors, hopefully by the end of October.
What is it about running these marathons that you take a lot of pride in, and you put a lot of energy into training and sharing your story? I'm almost feeling as though, I mean, I just got done talking with a book author. You might be somewhere. You might want to talk about I run marathons at 55 or 56.
There's a lot of folks out there who have a similar tale, but I think everybody who runs a marathon is unique and they do it for unique reasons. It might be that sound the same. You know, I run to run my personal best. I run to, you know, to do a minute better, you know, faster every day. But for me, you know, I run for a variety of reasons. The primary reason is I run to raise money. I can do a thing. And I believe that if you are capable of doing a thing and you can do it for the benefit of others, then you do it. So I run marathons, you know, to raise money for children, you know, children's cancer research and to benefit these families. It's not just for that, you know, the research and, you know, over the course of my time, I went to do the numbers recently just to look at things. My fundraising over the course of 4 years is up to $49,000. And our team, over the course of that same period of time, has raised about $10 million. I run with 160 other runners for Mass General Hospital. Mm. And every runner has a story. If you've gone through the city of Boston recently and you looked at Bank of America, you've seen the pictures of the charity marathon runners that they've been posting. And one of them was from our team, Quinn Nguyen, who lost her husband last year, right around this time. And they had laughed about running a marathon. And when she lost him, she said, "I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this for him," because cancer took her husband. And she promised at that point that she was going to do it. A tremendous story. Other people, doctors, nurses running it, parents running it for their children, you know, aunts and uncles and nieces. I run it so that I don't have to worry about, hopefully, my kids having to ever have to worry about this issue coming up in their lives. But I've got cancer in my family. So it's something that cuts deeply for me. Primarily, I'm running because I can. Because these kids can't, and so that's why I do it.
What I found was interesting, and then I asked you if we can kind of reprise the story on it, because we were talking about it in the break, in that you were kind of comparing running Boston, what it was like running Boston, the early stages when you're coming into the city, compared to what it's like you running the kind of give a comparison, if you will, to folks who may have never done, maybe they've run Boston, they've never run other marathons.
Right. Boston is iconic. There is only one Boston. You know, everybody comes to Boston. It's the one. Yeah, people run other marathons so that they can qualify for Boston. But if the actual running of the course is broken into pieces, the first 10 to 11 miles of Boston are kind of unremarkable. you're running through residential neighborhoods, you know, a lot of house parties and front lawns and things like that, Hopkinton, Ashland, you run past the dogs, you know, Spencer and Penny and the statue that they have there now, and they're grooming new puppies now to take over their role. And those all interesting little classically New England kinds of things, but it's not until you hit Wellesley and you hit what they call the Scream Tunnel. Out in front of Wellesley College, and you know the students line in the it's just, you know, with the best signs ever, but it's only then that you really start to feel like, okay, I'm in it. And then you get through Wellesley and you hit Newton, and then come the hills, and you know, mile 16, it's the hills, and then another hill, and then the firehouse, and then another hill.
So I'm going to stop you for half a second, and you get put a pin right here.
Sure.
So at what mile mark would you say that you actually feel you're in it? Is it the 5 mile, the 10 mile, the 12?
For me, I'm feeling it around mile 11.
Okay.
That, you know, once I hit Wellesley, my legs tell me I'm in it as soon as I cross the starting line. That they're like, oh, sure, God, sure. What are you doing to me again? But 11 is where you're like, okay. This is what I remember. Now there are landmarks, because here's Wellesley and here's the clock in the center of Wellesley, and oh, there's the cheese place, and you know, here's the park, and there's the police station, and now you're starting to get actual physical sights that you remember. Okay, here's what I need to do at this point, and your body starts to you have that muscle memory, and the mental aspect of it kicks in at that point too. Thank God it does. But you hit all of these hills. And you get through, and that's, you know, and the crowds for back of the pack runners like me, the crowds have dissipated. It's not the same feel as it is for the 2, 3, and 4 hour marathoners. New York is different in that you start with a hill. You have to run over the Verrazano Bridge, over 2.5 miles, exposed. And on the day I ran it, it was 78 degrees when we started, warmer than this past week. But then you're running through Brooklyn and all of the different, you're 9 miles through Brooklyn, and each half a mile or, you know, is a new neighborhood, and it's a new party, and it's new languages being spoken around you. And you're running, you know, here you're running through a Latinx neighborhood, and here you're running through an Italian section, and here you're running, and then you run through the Hasidic Jewish part, and they look at you like you've got lobsters coming out of your ears, literally. And what are you, you know, though, with the Goy, I'm running through my neighborhood, and they're literally crossing the street in front of running marathoners because they don't care. Mm. And you get up to Williamsburg, and then you hit Queens, and that's it's every neighborhood, every single borough is a party. You get, you know, through Manhattan, and then you cut up through the Bronx, and you know, and the Bronx, it's a different kind of feel. But then you're coming back through Manhattan again, down Fifth Avenue, and the crowds are right on top of you all night long. In Boston, I'm a back of the pack guy. I finish a marathon anywhere between 6 to 8 hours. This one took me over nine hours because of a variety of reasons. But crowds dissipate. You're alone. In New York, it took me 7+ hours to finish that marathon. And at no point was I alone. The crowds are constantly there, and they let you know it.
Would you feel as though you drew energy from the crowd, and that's what kind of propelled you?
Absolutely. There are points on the New York course where I felt, okay, I got to slow down. Maybe I can walk and then there's a crowd.
Yeah, you don't want to run yourself out.
Spilling out of bars, and they're screaming because I wear my name. One of the things that marathoners will do is they'll write their name on their shirts. And so people will yell your name, and they'll, come on, you know, and you go, and now all of a sudden you're juiced again. And that little hill that might have taken it out of you, now you got to get up that hill because they're cheering you up the hill. And down through, you know, you get through Manhattan, and they're yelling your name, and you're running down Fifth Avenue, and you run through Central Park. You know, there's a dead area at mile 16 where you're running over the Williamsburg Bridge, and you're going from Brooklyn back into Manhattan, first, you know, running at First Avenue, and it's dead silent. It's eerie. The only thing you hear is your breath and the feet around you of the other runners, because it's a covered bridge that runs for 1.75 miles. So you're surrounded by no humans other than the runners. And then you make the turn, a left turn out of Brooklyn into Manhattan on First Avenue, and it's like you got punched in the face. If you've ever gotten off an airplane in a hot climate where they make you get on the state,
oh, yeah,
and you get, on the tramway and the heat just hits you right in the face,
yeah,
this is the wall of sound that hits you when you hit First Avenue, mm, and you're like, okay, that bridge might have taken it out of me, but these people are putting it right back in me, and it gets me the rest of the way. If I could take the whole entirety of the crowds in New York and put them along the roads of Boston, that's the greatest marathon ever.
Well, now, it's, again, you've got a new challenge ahead. Now, when is Chicago?
Chicago is the week of October 15th.
Ah, so it'll be cooler weather.
Hopefully.
Okay.
You know, hopefully. The reason why they moved, New York used to run around Columbus Day, but the weather was too unpredictable, so they moved it to November thinking it would be cooler. Chicago is notoriously a cooler run, and it's a pretty flat run, which is also going to be very beneficial for me. And as people have described to me who have done it, phenomenal race. Again, crowds are there out there all. It's run on a Sunday, so the crowds are going to be out there, and people will actually hand you beers along the run. People will like stop every mile, and there are marathoners who make it a point of stopping every mile and drinking a beer, which I think is absurd. But then again, I couldn't imagine eating on marathons, and now I do.
Yeah,
but there are folks who they'll give you sausage sandwiches. It's amazing how Chicago apparently is. So I want the experience.
Let's do this. I want to, as you're prepping for Chicago, yep, when we get closer, have you in kind of let's see how the prep's going.
Yep.
But let's take the remaining time. And again, congratulations. I know you kind of social media. You were a little tough on yourself, and I'm like, you finished it. This you know, large LB'd SOB has never put 26 miles together running, and you've done it. You've done it five times.
Yep.
That's phenomenal.
Yep.
Congratulations. Whether it
was
6 hours or 10 hours, who cares? So congratulations, and we thank you. And it's cool to see you with your 128th running of the Boston Marathon medal.
I brought the medal in today. You know, you wear it whenever you can. So
I think it's awesome.
After today, it goes in the box. But
you've earned it.
Thank you.
As the Monday Night Talk legal expert. We've had you on previously, yep, to talk about things, the Karen Reed murder trial,
right,
that's ongoing, the picking the jury. Give me your thoughts at this point, because we've had a few things that have happened. I know that the defense has tried a couple of pretrial motions, mm-hmm, that have not been successful.
Right.
What are you watching and viewing as this is unfolding right now?
Right now, I'm amazed initially at the number of jurors that are being selected. Normally, with a murder trial or a capital felony or a major felony case, you're going to pick 16 people. You're going to put 12 in the box, and then you're going to have four alternates. The thing is, nobody knows who the alternates are. You're picking 16 people, and they're the ones who are going to sit there throughout the entirety of all of the evidence. And then once closing arguments are done and the jury is charged, they pick four names at random out of the barrel. And those people are the ones that are the alternates. Reason why you do that is you want to make sure everybody's paying attention all the way through. If somebody knows they're an alternate and they might not get picked, then maybe they don't pay attention for a particular day and piece of evidence eludes them.
Mm.
So you want to make sure everybody's on their game the entirety through the trial. But for this case, they've got 17 at this point now. But they're still going to be picking more jurors on Wednesday. Judge Canone wants to make sure that they have 20 jurors ready to go. And then as the trial starts, she can get rid of four if she needs to. The last four in can be the first four out. But apparently there is some question about availability, that a couple of jurors that were selected may not necessarily be available throughout the it's like taking a job but not really being able to take a job because you're not sure. So I understand why they're doing it, but if you're going to commit to serve on a jury, you get picked, you're in. So it seems odd. And as I mentioned, they've chosen more jurors for this trial than they did for the former president of the United States, whose opening argument started today down in New York. So that interesting as far as the jury selection is concerned. It is an involved process. the most time when you go into jury service, if you've ever served on a jury, you fill out the jury questionnaire. A lot of questions that, you know, are there. You know, are you able to serve in a fair and impartial manner? Do you have any pre-existing biases? But then each side also gets to submit other questions to the judge to have those questions asked to the jurors as well. Defense had, you know, do you have any ask questions? Do you have any issues about mothers against drunk driving? Or have you had any connection with any type of drunk driving cases in the past? This case revolves around whether the, you know, Karen Reed was in fact intoxicated and backed into, you know, John O'Keefe. So they're going to have issues related to drunken driving, and then whether this is something that may have happened, and if so, what effect that might have on whether a jury sees her as being culpable or not. But a lot of 39 different questions. The normal jury questionnaire has 26. They had 13 extra questions that went on, and one of the first questions they asked was, have you heard about this case on the first day of jury selection? Have you heard anything about this case? And they had 90 people in the room and 78 hands went up. That's, you know, and now you've got to weed through all 78 of those people
who might have already formed an opinion,
individually voir dire them and ask, do you have, you know, where did you hear about this? When did you hear about this? What information do you know? Have you heard the names of, you know, and have you formed, and then once they asked that first question, then they said, have you formed an opinion? And like 60 other, you know, it's a hard selection process. We talked about this in our previous discussions, that when there's so much media coverage, it's going to be very difficult to pick 16 people that either haven't heard of this or haven't, you know, any real exposure to it, and then people who don't have any preconceived notions about the specifics of the case, much less, you know, issues related to drunk driving and things of that nature. It was a difficult jury pool.
Is this too high profile of a case to sequester the jury, or will the jury be able to go home at night?
If I'm on the either side, I want them sequestered. I think that, you know, this case is, when I came up in New York, every trial jury was sequestered, every single one. We, you know, got to a point where we knew where all the hotels were based on the case, and you know, you could tell whether they were going to go to a Bronx hotel or to a Queens hotel. But here, this, it would be a tremendous inconvenience, but I think they should be sequestered from day one. But they won't do it. But I think there's certainly the possibility that once they get into active deliberations, that they would, you know, keep them sequestered. You've got a 6 to 8 week trial.
Yeah.
Jury, if they come back with a verdict in less than a day or a couple of days.
Trouble.
Huge trouble. So I think that there's definitely the chance that they would sequester.
We haven't gotten to that point yet, but this is probably going to be one of my final questions to you is, how important are opening statements? There was a segment I heard on the South Shore Morning News today, and I think they were talking about another trial, but it said that many times the opening statement can cement a juror one way or the other, and it can be very hard to sway them back depending on how the opening statement is delivered.
The idea of the opening statement is you want to begin to plant the seeds of what you want to get at going forward. It's especially important for the prosecution, because if the prosecution makes statements related to evidence in their opening statement, if they say you'll hear from this witness and this witness will say, or we will show the following, and during the course of the presentation of evidence they don't do that, or the witness that they said you're going to hear from, that you don't hear from, at that point, you can, as a defense attorney, you can file for a directed, you know, ask for a directed verdict against the prosecution. Because if they make a promise that they can't keep right off the bat, that's enough to get the case dismissed before it even gets to a jury. So for prosecutors, it's especially important that they say exactly what they're going to do, and they better be right about it. With any defense attorney doing an opening statement, this is where you begin to tell the jury what your theory of the case is. And it has to be plausible, and it has to be easily understood. If you confuse a jury right off the bat, you'll lose them. It has to be something very simple, and let them know where you're going. In this particular case, the theory is somebody else did it. one of the main defense theories is this: there's a third
cover up.
There's a third party actor who did this, or actors that did it, and there's a, they will not be allowed to talk about that theory in the opening, but the judge is going to allow them to present evidence during the course of the trial.
That was decided during pretrial motions,
that was decided during the pretrial. One of the motions in limine was, we're going to talk about third-party actor. And the judge allowed them to talk about third-party actor, but denied them the ability to talk about it in the opening statement, which is an odd little
nuance.
So they'll be able to talk about it when they close, if they're able to prove it, but you're not able to plant the seed right out, which makes things difficult because they can talk about other things. And honestly, in a case like this, you may want to have a very simple, short opening statement. It'll sound like a joke, and I don't mean to be but if you've ever seen, My Cousin Vinny, and the opening statement from Joe Pesci and My Cousin Vinny, everything those guys said
is BS.
It's BS. whatever that guy said. But sometimes it's the non-opening opening. I don't believe in it. I was taught you got to plant the seed early on and then follow through. Start the story and then make sure that you can follow through going forward. And give them something to latch on to. Start a theme. Trials are productions. Trials are, it's why great actors can be great lawyers and vice versa. It's all a production. You're getting them right from the start. You want them to start believing in your character. You want them to start believing in your story and how you tell it. And then you've got to go through the process of telling it. So a good opening is essential. And you've got good attorneys on both sides. They'll do the job.
He is Chris DiOrio. He is a defense attorney. He knows his stuff. We love having him here. Depending on how things trend this week or next week, love to have you back on. You don't have to drive all the way to Marshall, but have you call in and maybe kind of do kind of a drop in, maybe around 6:40.
No worries.
Let's see what happens. But I want to thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Congratulations on the marathon. And stay tuned as we're going to have more Chris in the coming weeks to talk about this Karen Reed case. Right now, though, we'll be back in a moment. We'll talk some NFL draft.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Located in downtown Whitman, McWiggins Pub is a fashionable, upscale Irish sports pub with a lively bar and dining room. With all the class of a Boston pub, McWiggins serves a great pub menu featuring favorites like beer-battered fried pickles, Reuben sandwiches, shepherd's pie, bangers and mash, and meatloaf. And of course, they have Guinness on tap. McWiggins is a great place to eat, drink, and socialize with family and friends. With 8 flat-screen TVs, you'll always find yourself in the center of the action of your favorite team. And don't forget the patio at McWiggins right next door. They're located at 546 and 552 Washington Street in downtown Whitman.
I'm Peter Brown of Tiny & Sons Auto Glass in Pembroke. People ask me, is there anything they can do to prevent getting a broken windshield?
Is there anything I can do to prevent getting a broken windshield?
See? There is. Those big gravel trucks, when they're being loaded, rocks get stuck in the framework of the bed. Truck hits a bump, rock hits your windshield. It pays to stay way back.
It pays to stay way back.
However, if your windshield is broken, just call 1-888-64-TINIES. And thank you.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
And we return to the final segment of Monday Night Talk. I tell you, I could have talked with Chris another half hour talking about the Karen Reed case. He knows his stuff. It's great the way we were able to kind of break it down. But he will be back on to kind of give his thoughts as to how things are trending. Again, great to have him on to kind of talk about that. But we turn our focus. Do you know that the NFL draft is this coming Thursday night? I missed the days when it was just like one night, or it was one day. And now they broke it up, and it's like three nights. And half the time, like, I try to watch it on Friday and Saturday, and it's kind of like, all right, I'm fully paying attention on Thursday night because they care about the first round draft picks. Although, Brendan, you may agree with me, and that is just how with the New England Patriots, you know, during the Bill Belichick era, a lot of times we're gonna pick at 21. Patriots have traded out of the pick, and they're gonna be picking.
It was a fait accompli.
Yeah. You knew that it was, you know, because they didn't want to pay that first round draft pick money.
We can find value elsewhere.
We can find value. You know, if we can get like a couple of number twos and a couple of number threes for our number one, well, gosh, Jenny, we've got value. But I brought in, last year we had Quinn Kelly, and Quinn did a great job, but Quinn was forthright saying, I'm kind of big on the NFL draft. And I know Brendan's kind of like a honk like that. And I'm like, I planted the seed. I'm like, oh, next year you're going to have Brendan come in. So Brendan Conley, by the way, first and foremost, I don't know if the world knows this because you are you're a big thing on X, but congratulations. There's a Conley on its way.
Yeah, almost at 10,000 followers on Twitter. I'm kind of stunned myself, but after 10 years in this business, yeah. You have to pay your dues, and hope to get there real soon.
So give me your thoughts on this upcoming draft. How much are you paying attention to it? Are you a guy who likes to watch from the first draft to Mr. Irrelevant, or are you more so the first couple of rounds?
I always watch the first two rounds, usually from start to finish, because I feel like that's where you're going to find the most stars. I'm always curious to see what the Patriots as a team are going to do. Like past years, it was almost, like I said, a given that they were going to trade out of it, but you wondered what were they going to get in return. This year's a different story. You've got a whole new coaching staff in there. They're picking number three, which is the highest they've picked in quite some time. So what do I think they're going to do with it? My gut would be, I feel like they should take a quarterback. I don't know if I'm 100% sold that they're going to just yet.
Really? What? Why are you wavering?
You see what's going on underneath this team throughout the board, and I still get the sense that they just haven't committed to one of these, I wouldn't say three guys. I feel like Caleb Williams is the automatic number one pick this year just because he has the most raw talent of the three quarterbacks up at the top. And then after that, it's kind of a question of, are they looking for a guy like Jaden Daniels who's played at a high level for quite some time and I feel like it might be more pro-ready, or do they take a shot on a guy with potentially a high ceiling like Drake May? All signs right now, all the experts think that it's going to be May who falls to them. If May does fall to them, though, I don't know if they're completely sold on him yet. He has been met with the team. He's been dined by them, as have the other quarterbacks.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know if they've committed to him being the guy yet.
It's funny you say that. So what Brendan and I have, I was able to pull. I was going to try to do, you know, the Todd McShays, the usual big names, Mel Kiper Juniors, but. You had to subscribe to ESPN Plus, and you have to pay it. I'm like, I'm not paying for it.
You can watch TV now off and games with that now too.
You can, but so what I did is, everybody knows who Peter Schrager is, right?
Yep.
Right. He's a co-host of Good Morning Football. He's also on NFL.com, and I was able to grab his mock draft from a few days ago, and also I got Eric at home. He is somebody who has been, for more than two decades, he's written for Sporting News, Pro Football Weekly, and Yahoo Sports. And he's also been focusing on the past several years on the draft. So, but what's even more interesting is that these are two guys who do work for NFL Network. By the way, Ed Holmes' mock draft is a 3.0 as compared to Schrager's, who's this 1.0. But when I look at the first four picks for the Bears, the Washington Commanders, the Patriots, and the Giants, it's as though they were cheating off. They were like, someone was looking on someone else's test scores because they have their first four, the first five draft picks are the same. Is it possible that this is what everybody is saying, like Caleb Williams from USC, he's he is going to be the number one draft pick.
I think he's going to be the number one draft pick this year, and then it's a toss-up between Drake May and Jaden Daniels after that. It's a question of where teams want to go. My question is, do the Patriots stay there and take one of those quarterbacks? And my antenna went up a few weeks ago when the Minnesota Vikings started loading up on capital in the first round. Multiple first-round picks. They have to pick the next quarterback for them because Kirk Cousins is gone.
Yep.
They have some pieces that are valuable and could, you know, shine for a team like New England. I could possibly see them maybe making a splash deal. I just don't know if Jerod Mayo and Elliott Wolf want to take that risk right now. Do you just take the quarterback and look for the next guy in your own system? Or do you try to make a deal and try to fill a few holes? I don't know. I could see either one happening.
Well, what's interesting is I actually heard I heard a segment featuring Kevin O'Connell, who is a former New England Patriots quarterback, right? We drafted mm-hmm. him. And he is the head coach for the Minnesota Vikings, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying that, you know, he can fix quarterbacks. If they take a quarterback that, you know, he's a quarterback killer, but he also knows how to fix if there's something wrong, especially from the waist down, if the footwork isn't all that good. It's interesting that there are some teams that are needy. I don't know if you got the 11th hour update, but Zach Wilson is no longer. So they went from one Wilson to another.
I was kind of surprised by that because I felt like, I don't know how long the window for Aaron Rodgers is, and I don't know if you watch Hard Knocks occasionally on HBO, the football show that they do on each team.
Yeah.
Yeah. Last year, I watched the Jets one. I watched the Jets one too. Because I wanted to see how Aaron Rodgers connected with the players, and surprisingly, one of the few I feel like he really did connect with was actually Zach Wilson, like just as like an older brother figure.
Do you feel that do you feel as though he didn't see him as a threat?
I don't think he did. But I felt like he might have saw him as a successor, like later.
Mm.
Like the guy just needed more development, I think.
I have seen stories that have said that, you know, the Jets started out 4-3 under Zach Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
But then it quickly fell apart. Yeah. They couldn't score. But a lot of writers are saying that they feel as though that Wilson was a scapegoat, that, you know, you had a patchwork offensive line, and it just you had inept people at key positions on the offense, and you can't score that way.
Yeah, it's hard. It makes it much more difficult when your line doesn't give you much help, and they do have some offensive weapons on the outside. They have some good running backs, but they have a great defense. I just feel like he was a casualty of the situation. I had his bad moments, and it blew up because he was on a bigger stage in New York.
So let's talk. So we've decided that Caleb Williams is going to be, he'll be the first one. The question mark that we have here is the Commanders. Are the Commanders sold on Jaden Daniels, or are they looking, do they have a grass is greener over on the other side? Maybe they think Drake May might be more a better fit. There has been word that Jaden Daniels doesn't necessarily. No, I don't know if this is a leak from the Daniels camp or if this is just pre-draft, you know, dust up, but that Daniels would prefer to play for the Patriots and not necessarily for the Commanders. And I've also heard that the Commanders may be leaning more towards Drake May because this kid is a little bit more proven. He's a little bit more stout. He's not necessarily got a slender build. I mean, Daniels reminds me of Robert Griffin III, who was, he could run, but he was also, you know, he didn't have a thick enough frame to be able to absorb some of the hits you take in the NFL.
And Jaden Daniels isn't really too big. He's 210 pounds. But I feel like he might be the most mentally ready of the three quarterbacks, just given the fact that he was on a big stage for so many years in the college ranks. He played for some of the biggest programs in the country, always in the SEC or the Big Ten. And I just feel like when you play under a spotlight like that for a long time, when it gets to this stage, you can be somewhat more ready. I think Drake May's kind of an unknown at this stage of the game. We'll have to see how it goes, however, because he's got talent. He's got talent, and it's there. He's got strength. Everyone's looking for the next Pat Mahomes. He might be closer to that build, but I think Caleb Williams is the most talented of the three right now.
Okay. So when we look at the Patriots, and again, you're kind of sitting here saying, you're hearing that there's a possibility that they may trade the pick. But the most recent thing that has come out is that Elliott Wolf, who is the de facto general manager right now, that it's going to need to be a package that will wow the New England Patriots.
Oh, it's got to be a big one. If you're Minnesota, for instance, you got to give up 11-23 and then another piece.
I heard on another radio station, a sports radio station in the Boston area, where the term biggie bag, you know, it's like you're filling that thing up with cheeseburgers and nuggets, and it has to be enticing enough to be able to kind of release the grasp of that pick.
Yeah, because this is not a normal pick for the Patriots. This isn't 21 through 32. This is number three.
Yeah.
Like, you're picking a real
player. This is somebody who's going to be a foundational piece.
So a few years ago, there were five quarterbacks, and I would say of the ones that panned out, maybe only one, Trevor Lawrence.
Every one of them have been traded.
Mac Jones fell to the Patriots at 15.
He's now a Jaguar, too,
ironically. You're Justin, picking at three, however.
Justin you Fields have,
you
with
have
Pittsburgh.
A whole crop of amazing talent to work with. Who knows? Maybe they don't even pick a quarterback. I think they're going to pick a quarterback.
But see, that's the thing. And for weeks, and that's why I can't wait for the draft to be over. Because just some.
That's like, why I give it more a shot. That I think they're going to take a quarterback, or they're going to trade out the pick and accumulate
assets. But then I've also heard the noise of Marvin Harrison Jr. You want to take this. This is a generational talent. Mm-hmm. You want to take this kid. Or Joe Alt. This is a guy who will be, you know, he will be a major part of that line for the next 12 to 15 years.
Lord knows they need help there.
They do need help. And if you're looking for, an offensive tackle, he's going to be it. And let's not forget, you know, he's got lineage. His father was in the NFL. And they're saying that this is a guy who he's a great protector. And the blind side is key. But, you know, what good is to get a Joe Alt? What, to protect, you know, Jacoby Brissett?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. I don't think so.
I feel like they got to find another quarterback, be it out here in the draft in the top three picks,
yep,
or via the market somehow. And right now, there's just not much out there. I think Ryan Tannehill was still available at last check.
He is.
Yeah. Do you want 35-year-old Ryan Tannehill at this stage? No, I don't think so.
No, he's a good quarterback, but he's the quarterback who's going to take you to the next level. Is he going to win you a championship?
As in Tannehill, or
I'm saying,
no.
Do you want a good quarterback, or you want somebody who's going to be a Patrick Mahomes? I mean,
exactly.
Of the quarterbacks that have gone that have lost the Super Bowl, I mean, Patrick Mahomes lost his first, you know, his first time going to the Super Bowl, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then he bounced back and he's won three.
He's catching up to Brady pretty quick.
Yeah.
I heard Brady was on a podcast the other day. The Deep Cut podcast? And he said he could come back. You want Tom Brady?
I don't know.
46 years old.
I don't know. I mean, when Tom didn't, you'd have to put. I think you would have to put pieces around Tom.
Yes.
Tom's at that point where he can't do. He's pretty darn good, but you need to have some key pieces.
Yeah, and I feel like, who knows? Maybe they already picked up the phone on that. I don't know, but I feel like, if I'm Jerod Mayo and Elliott Wolf, I want to make a pick here in this top three.
Okay.
I want to pick my biggest position in need, which I think is quarterback at this moment. You still don't have that piece. You just have a backup depth guy in Jacoby Brissett who's been here. He's not going to get you to the pinnacle.
Good point. So here's the other thing that's interesting is there's also been chatter about J.J. McCarthy. This is a guy who...
That guy has been shooting up the draft boards as of late.
He is.
He was originally going to be a top 20 to 25 pick. Now some are saying he might get as high as four.
And he was seen at Patriot Place being wined and dined with the other the other three candidates who are quarterbacks as well. So if we look at Schrager and Ed Holmes' mock drafts, at number four, both of them project a trade, but they project trades
with different teams.
Different teams, and both want
J.J. McCarthy. He could go as high as a top five in this pick in this draft, and some people have said that he just is the ideal Patriot, just given his personality. But if I'm looking at this from the Patriots' perspective, I want to take a guy who I know has a higher ceiling, somebody with higher talent. I feel like J.J. McCarthy might be a good leader. I don't know if he's ready yet for the NFL. I don't know how long it'll take. It could take a year, maybe two. But I don't think he's ready right now.
Okay. So we look at pick five. And both of pick five, choosing at number five, I wish we had the draft, you know, the little sounder. Chargers are at number five. Both Schrager and Ed Holm say that Marvin Harrison Jr. falls to the new coach.
I mean,
falls to the Chargers.
I could definitely see him not going at number five. I've also heard him sliding down a few draft boards to as low as like 10. But he's a generational talent at a position that is going to be hard to find. It's going to be hard to find somebody of that caliber. And he might be – is he going to be as great as his father was in the NFL? I don't know. Tall task, but
– Well, also look who's throwing the ball to his father. Look who, you know –
That's true.
You know,
Peyton Manning.
Peyton Manning, who is, you know – Hall of Fame.
If he ends up with the Chargers, that's a pretty good start for him. I think that's a good quarterback, a guy who needs a player like that. So I could definitely see the Chargers being a candidate.
Okay. So pick six.
Especially given the fact that they just lost Keenan Allen, their top producing receiver from the last decade.
Did they lose? I thought they lost two receivers.
Did they lose Mike Williams too?
Mike Williams.
I could definitely see them.
I thought Mike Williams, they might have. I don't know if he signed.
I forget if he signed with another team.
He may have signed with.
I know Keenan Allen left.
What's important is that Google is your friend.
That's true.
And I can quickly look up to see if Mike Williams indeed was signed by someone or not. Yeah, he is with the New York Jets.
Yep.
Right? Big body, 6'4". A great target. I don't know if he was traded.
Weapon for Aaron Rodgers, who can jump high and make those big catches.
He needs a
Hail Mary catcher.
Short-handed receiver, but he also makes – hopefully Williams can stay healthy. That's kind of a key. So we jumped down to six. This is, again, don't forget we had a trade earlier on at four on Schrager's. This is where he had the projected trade. So Arizona will be picking, and they will be taking Rome Odunze. Am I saying that right?
I believe so.
Okay.
Wide out for
from Washington.
Kyler Murray,
yep.
Who they've actually – I'm surprised. It sounds like they're committing to him longer term than we expected. So,
Interesting. But then they have the Giants grabbing Malik Nabers, LSU wide receiver. He's a junior. So that's interesting, giving a weapon to Daniel Jones. We jump down to seven, pick number seven, the Tennessee Titans. And both Schrager and Ed Holm are saying that Joe Alt will go to the Titans. And the Titans were very, very busy in the offseason.
Oh, they were making moves left and right. Yep. They parted ways with Mike Vrabel. So it's going to look like an entirely different franchise next year. A whole new scheme, whole new everything. And the best way to start is to build that offensive line because it makes it a lot easier for all your other pieces.
So if we look at number eight, pick number eight is Atlanta. Schrager has Dallas Turner. He's a... off the edge from Alabama. And at home has Byron Murphy, the second, a DT, defensive tackle, going to the Falcons.
That was their biggest Achilles heel was their defense last year. They could score. They were able to trade punches with other teams offensively, but they would get into these like 28, 27 shootouts and fall short every time. So... you could see why they shore up things on the defensive end. The question is, which direction do they want to go? Do you want to fix the back end or do you want to fix the front side?
All right, so we go to pick number nine, and we're not going to do all these. We'll get to 10, and then if you want to pick a couple from 11 to 31, who you think might be interesting in these two mock drafts, we can do that. We're up to number nine. And projected trade, both Schrager and Edholm says that there's going to be a trade with the Chicago Bears where the Colts will pick up, they're going to pick a receiver. Schrager says Malik Nabers, it's the junior wide out from
LSU. Jaden Daniels' target.
Yep. And Brock Bowers. That's the
big tight end from Georgia.
Big tight end from the Bulldogs, junior. So that's interesting. And then 10, call this interesting, more weapons for Aaron Rodgers. Schrager says that Brock Bowers will instead go to the Jets, where Ed Holmes says Rome Odunze is going to the Jets. So it's an offensive weapon, regardless of how you look.
Well, that's what Aaron Rodgers needs, and I think he's already got a lot on the outside. Can they fix that line? That would certainly help him and his comeback from his rehab. I feel like this team offensively can score a lot of points, and Bowers would offer you some blocking on that front, because I feel like he's kind of more of a blocking tight end. He's not too big on the offensive end, but he's still a weapon as well, can make those tight catches. And I think with Aaron Rodgers throwing the ball, he can obviously get better on that.
Okay. So if I'm looking through here, and I've picked a couple, one from each. On Schrager's pick number 23, the Minnesota Vikings select senior QB from Oregon, Bo Nix.
Well, if they don't end up moving into that first round and getting one of those top four quarterbacks, I could see them going this route very easily. Yeah. If they end up keeping those two picks and they aren't able to unload them for a huge haul, I could just see them sticking here and just taking a shot on the guy from Oregon, Bo Nix. And then we'll see what they do at 11, too. That's going to be huge.
And then Ed Holmes says that the Raiders are going to pick Michael Penix Jr., the senior QB from Washington. So
Tom Brady might have a say in that, too. We don't know.
We'll you think see. So? Oh, that's it, right. Ownership.
Ownership.
Ownership has its...
Depends which way he wants to go. Maybe he does play for the Patriots or another team, but I doubt it. I think we're going to see him go to the TV route, and then he'll do some ownership on the side as well, I think.
We have been joined this evening with Brendan Codley, part of the WATD Sports Department, also writes for the Boston Herald, and is a fantastic reporter. If you're looking at the Patriots in their later rounds, it's super obvious that this is a deep draft when it comes to wide receivers. Mm-hmm. Hopefully they're going to grab a wide out. Maybe somebody who might have played. If they do grab Drake May, I think that he has a teammate mm-hmm. who is, I believe, that's going to be in the draft as well.
Mm-hmm. I can't put my finger to his name right now.
It's not. But I know that there's been conversations.
Yes.
Tackle. You've got to do something with the offensive line.
Oh, my God. You have to restore the offensive line. You've got to restore things at quarterback, and you need to add help in the wide receiver department. I think they just have to focus heavy offense this year. They lost a couple of defensive pieces, but for the most part, I think they still are pretty strong on that front. They re-signed Kyle Duggar to a long-term deal. Matt Judon's still here for another season. I feel like on that side of the ball, they should be decent. I feel like they should just go heavy offense in this draft, whether that is through trades or they stick with their picks.
But if you do go defense, where are you going? Are you going line? Are you going linebacker? Because there's a couple of good linebackers
safety,
as well.
Maybe too. I mean, you lost the McCourty. Matt sure. Slater is gone as well.
Sure.
So
yeah, but a special team's going to play a role. And do you draft another kicker?
I don't know if they should.
You drafted a kicker last year.
It hasn't worked out very well.
You drafted a kicker last year, and how's he doing? How did he do? Right, yeah.
I feel like you're better off just signing a guy who's been in the league.
Well, you could have re-signed Nick Folk, but you let that.
Right.
Just
sign a guy off the heap, because a lot of those guys are just so in tune mentally that they don't worry about the change in market. A lot of these young kickers out of college, they either are perfect or they are bust. Like, I think Harrison Butker might be the closest one to a great one in recent years that was taken in the draft, I think, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. It's a lot of pressure on these kids, and some of them just don't pan out.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, special teams, well, I mean, they have...
I don't want them drafting a kicker. Don't draft a goddamn kicker.
All right. GD kicker. Well, we'll see what happens. It's going to be interesting. definitely would love to have you back on maybe in a couple of weeks. Maybe we've got to break it down. Maybe
get a recap.
Have a special guest join us. Maybe we'll see if Jerry Thornton's available.
Mm, that'd be fun.
To join us, and he can...
We'll grade them.
He can pontificate on whether or not they made the right moves, although he'll admit that he's a bit of a homer, but he does so, with the right reasons,
right,
per se. So it's always great to have him on. Thank you so much for joining us on the show tonight. Anything good coming up for you?
So a lot of coverage for the Boston Herald in addition to WATD on the high school sports front, the Celtics playoffs, and the Bruins as well. So I also run the lacrosse notebook for the Boston Herald, so you can read my columns in there weekly.
Are you saying high school lacrosse?
High school lacrosse notebook, yeah.
Watch out for Abington.
They're doing pretty well this year. They were one of my dark horse teams. Yeah. I picked them. I know your affinity for the Green Wave.
Well, it's kind of a given, as I'm
right.
You know, I kind of do a lot of their coverage. So
that's and true.
They put their heart and souls in a lot of their games, and great parental support, and it's just a great community.
The South Shore is stacked when it comes to lacrosse this year. I wouldn't be surprised to see maybe two to three teams from here win titles.
We'll see what happens. And I'm also watching Abington girls softball.
Mm, they're always good.
They're a wagon.
They're always watch a pretty good team.
So, well, again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks again, Kevin.
And I want to thank not only all of our guests for joining us, but thank you, the audience, for tuning in to another Monday Night Talk. Remember, podcasts are up. They're up to date. Any shows that you've missed, you can always go to 959WATD.com or Google is your friend. You can find us on Spotify for all the last shows to be able to tune in. I ask you if you have any ideas for segments. Monday Night Talk at gmail.com. Till next week at 6:15 p.m., have yourself a great night.